This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to The Economist, offering authoritative insight and opinion on international news, politics, business, finance, science, and technology. Stay tuned for the go-to magazine for great minds around the globe, right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is a reading of The Economist, and I'm your reader, Mary Kiefer, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I will be reading from the July 26th, 2025 issue of The Economist Newspaper Limited. And now I will begin with The Economics of Superintelligence. If Silicon Valley's predictions are even close to being accurate, expect unprecedented upheaval. For most of history, the safest prediction has been that things will continue much as they are. But sometimes the future is unrecognizable. The tech bosses of Silicon Valley say humanity is approaching such a moment, because in just a few years, artificial intelligence will be better than the average human being at all cognitive tasks. You do not need to put high odds on them being right to see that their claim needs thinking through. Were it to come true, the consequences would be as great as anything in the history of the world economy. Since the breakthroughs of almost a decade ago, AI's powers have repeatedly and spectacularly outrun predictions. This year, large language models from OpenAI and Google DeepMind got to gold in the International Mathematical Olympiad, 18 years sooner than experts had predicted in 2021. The models grow ever larger, propelled by an arms race between tech firms, which expect the winner to take everything, and between China and America, which fear systemic defeat if they come second. By 2027, it should be possible to train a model using 1,000 times the computing resources that built GPT-4, which lies behind today's most popular chatbot. What does that say about AI's power in 2030 or 2032? As we describe in one of two briefings this week, many fear a hellscape in which AI-enabled terrorists build bioweapons that kill billions, or a misaligned AI slips its leash and outwits humanity. It is easy to see why these tail risks command so much attention. Yet, as our second briefing explains, they have crowded out thinking about the immediate, probable, predictable, and equally astonishing effects of a non-apocalyptic AI. Before 1700, the world economy grew on average by 8% a century. Anyone who forecast what happened next would have seemed deranged. Over the following 300 years, as the Industrial Revolution took hold, growth averaged 350% a century. That brought lower mortality and higher fertility. Bigger populations produced more ideas, leading to yet faster expansion. Because of the need to add human talent, the loop was slow. Eventually, greater riches led people to have fewer children. That boosted living standards, which grew at a steady pace of about 2% a year. AI faces no such demographic constraint. Technologists promise that it will rapidly hasten the pace at which discoveries are made. Sam Altman, OpenAI's chief executive, expects AI to be capable of generating novel insights next year. AIs already help program better AI models. By 2028, some say they will be overseeing their own improvement. hence the possibility of a second explosion of economic growth. If computing power brings about technological advances without human input, and enough of the payoff is reinvested in building still more powerful machines, wealth could accumulate at unprecedented speed. Economists have long been alive to the relentless mathematical logic of automating the discovery of ideas. According to a recent projection by Epoch A1, a bullish think tank, once AI can carry out 30% of tasks, annual growth will exceed 20%. True believers, including Elon Musk, conclude that self-improving AI will create a superintelligence. Humanity would gain access to every idea to be had, including for building the best robots, rockets, and reactors. Access to energy and human lifespan would no longer impose limits. The only constraint on the economy would be the laws of physics. You don't need to go to that extreme to conjure up AI's mind-boggling effects. Consider, as a thought experiment, just the incremental step to human-level intelligence. In labor markets, the cost of using computing power for a task would limit the wages for carrying it out. Why pay a worker more than the digital competition? Yet the shrinking number of superstars whose skills were not automatable and could directly complement AI would enjoy enormous returns. The only people doing better than them in all likelihood would be the owners of AI-relevant capital, which would be gobbling up a rising state of economic output. Everyone else would have to adapt to gaps in AI's abilities and to the spending of the new rich. Wherever there was a bottleneck in automation and labor supply, wages could rise rapidly. Such effects, known as cost disease, would be so strong as to limit the explosion of measured GDP, even as the economy changed utterly. The new patterns of abundance and shortage would be reflected in prices. Anything AI could help produce, goods from fully automated factories, say, or digital entertainment, would see its value collapse. If you fear losing your job to AI, you can at least look forward to lots of such things. Wherever humans were still needed, cost disease might bite. Knowledge workers who switched to manual work might find they could afford less childcare or fewer restaurant meals than today, and humans might end up competing with AIs for land and energy. This economic disruption would be reflected in financial markets. There could be wild swings between stocks as it became clear which companies were winning and losing winner-take-all contests. There would be a rapacious desire to invest, both to generate more AI power and in order for the stock of infrastructure and factories to keep pace with economic growth. At the same time, the desire to save for the future could collapse as people, and especially the rich who do the most saving, anticipated vastly higher incomes. Persuading people to give up capital for investment would therefore require much higher interest rates. High enough, perhaps, to make long-duration asset prices fall, despite explosive growth. Scholars disagree, but in some models, interest rates rise one for one or more with growth. In an explosive scenario, that would mean having to refinance debts at 20-30%. Even debtors whose incomes were rising fast could suffer. Those whose incomes were not hitched to runaway growth would be pummeled. countries that were unable or unwilling to exploit the A1 boom could face capital flight. There could also be macroeconomic instability anywhere because inflation could take off as people binged on their anticipated fortunes and central banks did not raise rates fast enough. It is a dizzying thought experiment. Could humanity cope? Growth has accelerated before, but there was no mass democracy during the Industrial Revolution. The Luddites, history's most famous machine haters, did not have the vote. Even if average wages surged, higher inequality could lead to demands for redistribution. The state would also have more powerful tools to monitor and manipulate the population. Politics would therefore be volatile. Governments would have to rethink everything from the tax base to education to the protection of civil rights. Despite that, the rise of superintelligence should provoke wonder. Dario Amodei, boss of Anthropic, told The Economist this week that he believes AI will help treat once incurable diseases. The way to look at another acceleration, if it comes, is as the continuation of a long miracle, made possible only because people embraced disruption. Humanity may find its intelligence surpassed. It will still need wisdom. From Atlanta, just because you can. The rise of the women's sports bar. The hum is nothing unusual. Talking heads on the television comment on the last play of the game, and fans woot when the players hit big shots. But there are signs that it's not your normal sports bar. The menu features both bulgogi, beef tacos, and girl dinner, a charcuterie board with dried apricots and olives. Instead of Heineken and tequila sodas, the drinks offering include the Sporty Spice Margarita, the 9-to-5 Espresso Martini, and the Red Card, a chilled fireball shot. The clientele is conspicuously lacking in Y chromosomes. So are the athletes on the screen. This is Jolene Jolene, a woman's sports bar. Chelsea Fishman, its owner, opened Jolene Jolene in Atlanta on July 4th. That weekend, 500 people came. The bar is a place for anyone who is tired of asking bartenders to change the channel to a women's game, she said. On a recent evening, the bar was bubbling. We've been wanting this for as long as we can remember, says a former college basketball point guard eating wings. Jolene Jolene is among the first women's sports bar. The movement started when Jenny Nguyen, a chef and basketball aficionado, founded the Sports Bra in Portland, Oregon in 2022. Her niche is quickly becoming less niche, and there are now about 10 women's sports bars. Over a dozen more, Babes, The Final Period, and Tomboys, to name a few, are raising funds, renting spaces, and finalizing booze lists. The entrepreneurs, who tend to be first-time businesswomen, share tips and frustrations on a group chat that adds members each week. The bars are opening in part because the games they screen are more popular than ever. Deloitte, a consulting firm, estimates that women's sports will generate $2.4 billion in global revenue this year, up from $98 million in 2023. Many attribute the change to the women's national soccer team and to Caitlin Clark, a basketball player who smashed records at the University of Iowa, then became last year's top pick for the Women's National Basketball Association. The 2024 college championship game that she played in drew 24 million viewers in its final minutes, more than any college game ever had on ESPN. America's biggest sports network. In May, a WNBA team in San Francisco played its first game. Due to surging demand, the league plans to add 5 more teams. At Jolene Jolene, fans need not fear that televisions will switch away from a women's game to show a men's one. Ms. Fishman is adamant that Jolene Jolene is a women's sports bar, not a bar just for women. When asked, its patrons say they are happy for men to join in too. But if women's sports are to become truly mainstream, one says, then the NBA ought to rename itself the MNBA. Nay bother. Mongolia is a nation of horsemen. In the 13th century, its cavalry, led by Genghis Khan, conquered huge chunks of Asia and Europe. These days, the country puts its equine expertise to different uses. It is leading efforts to rewild perhaps the world's most endangered horse. The beasts in question are known to Mongolians as Takis, and to this wider world as Przewalski's horse. Genetically, these animals are about as far removed from a common nag as it is possible for a horse to be. They have additional chromosomes for a start. Romantics call them the world's truly last wild horses. Unlike other free roamers such as Mustangs, the Takis have never been tamed. The animal was unknown to Western horse fanciers until the late 19th century, when Nikolai Przewalski, a Russian explorer, brought home proof of life. Cue a grim horse rush that nearly did them in. Mongolian hunters trapped foals on demand for foreign collectors, often killing the parents in the process. Habitat loss and climate shocks later thinned the herd. By the late 1960s, there were none at all left in the wild. That blow spurred conservationists in lots of places to breed the ones they had in captivity better. These had themselves fared terribly for a time, dwindling in number to only about 30. This has been a qualified success. Today there are probably some 2,000 to 2,500 Przewalski's horses. That is no army, but it is a relief given how close they came to the abyss. These horses are being returned to their old homes at Hustai National Park, not far from Mongolia's capital, Ulaanbaatar. Your correspondent spies the stocky animals cresting a ridge. Some 350 live on the reserve, the park director said. That is the biggest population in one place in the world. And it is one of these reserves in Mongolia, hosting around 800 of them in all. Mongolia is not the only country rewilding this singular horse. In June, 6 bred in European zoos were released in Kazakhstan. China has reserves for them too, but the task is especially important to Mongolians, notes G.G. as Jargal, a botanist in Hustai, as she watches them gather at a stream. Preserving the Takis is about preserving our identity, she says. Sting like the bee. How satire is adapting to the second coming of Donald Trump. After America's presidential election last year, a headline in The Onion, a liberal satirical newspaper, was "Trump calls Harris to congratulate himself on winning." Technically, this joke is almost perfect. It is only 8 words long, one of which elegantly subverts the other 7. Yet it has a serious flaw. No one would be surprised if it were true. And that illustrates a huge problem for satirists in the age of Donald Trump. He should be easy to mock, but he is not. One reason is that reality often overtakes satire. Scott Dickers, a former editor of The Onion, chuckles as he recalls how many jokes from a Trump book he published in 2017 now read like news reports. Donald Trump's world map, for instance, shows Canada as the next 50 states. A fictional speech to the National Science Foundation ends with Mr. Trump saying, "We're going to get tough on science, and a few eggheads might get fired. Big deal." Philip Roth, a novelist, defined satire as moral outrage transformed into comic art. It is supposed to shame the target, but how can that work when the target is shameproof? His personal vanity is unshakable, marvels Ian Hislop, the editor of Private Eye, a British satirical magazine. Also, the idea of truth doesn't interest him. So the satirist's staple of pointing out a politician's hypocrisies and inconsistencies does not work. You can still do that, but it's just one of those things, like the sky is blue and water is wet, says Luke Gordon Field, who edits the Beaverton, a wry Canadian news website. Surprisingly, the satirists who are coping best with a second Trump term are often not the liberals who find him repugnant, but conservatives who have a soft spot for him while acknowledging some of his gargantuan flaws. Consider the Babylon Bee, a conservative satirical website set up in 2016. Its worldview is poles apart from that of most secular comics. The existence of God is taken for granted. Are your kids possessed by demons or just normal toddlers? Is a typical headline. Though its readers probably voted for Mr. Trump, they notice if he does things Jesus might frown at. For example, when he posted an AI-generated picture of himself as Pope, the Bee poked fun at his presumption by suggesting changes he might make if installed in the Vatican. These included painting his own face over Adam's in the Sistine Chapel and issuing more macho papal decrees. Any saint who was martyred loses sainthood for being a wimp. Sad. On policy, the Bee's writers clearly sympathize with Mr. Trump, yet they skewer his capriciousness. Trump draws names of countries from hat to determine next tariff. And his excesses. One story reports him ordering the removal of black pieces from all chess sets for being a move behind every other piece in the set. Absolutely failing. These are clearly DEI hires, and we need to fire them. When Mr. Trump's administration announced plans to kick Chinese students out of America, the Bee responded with the headline, "American students unsure who to cheat off after Trump revokes Chinese student visas." Democrats who wonder why more than half the country dislikes them could usefully spend time pursuing the Bee. It flays their tiresome sanctimony. Disaster. Liberal goes back in time to kill Hitler, but now has no one to compare people he disagrees with to. Their unrigorous ideas about schooling, layoffs delayed as Department of Education unable to calculate what 50% of employees would be, and their skepticism of market forces. In retrospect, women attending communist-themed party should have realized there wouldn't be any food. It highlights how much middle America hates rioting, a problem many associate with the defund the police left. One headline mocks both the Trump administration's anti-tax zeal and progressive scofflaws. Elon Musk disguises IRS building as Tesla dealership, so Democrats will burn it down. The Bee also offers a handy gauge of tensions. within the MAGA movement. Many of Mr. Trump's fans are furious at his failure to release a full list of clients of the late Jeffrey Epstein, a sexual predator and party thrower for the rich and famous, despite what he said on the campaign trail. His order on July 18th to release more papers may disappoint, since it is not clear that the list exists. MAGA diehards feel betrayed. The Bee offered 7 totally plausible explanations for why Pam Bondi, Mr. Trump's attorney general, has yet to publish the Epstein files she said was on her desk, including she really had the list, but her dog ate it, and she was going to try to piece it back together, but then some Haitians ate the dog. Mr. Trump has been famous for longer than most Americans have been alive. New York tabloids have been ridiculing him since the 1980s. Because he is so familiar, jokes about him often seem stale. Enough already about his hair and his skin tone. Lampooning his flunkies and his policies can sound fresher. The Onion's take on his vaccine-scorning health secretary was bleakly hilarious. RFK Jr. vows to make measles deaths so common they won't be upsetting anymore. So was its view of his deportations. ICE agent decides he wants kids after seeing incredible love and devotion of parents begging him not to take their child. The Bee attracted 4.2 million page visitors in June, according to estimates by SEMrush, a marketing platform. The Onion claims 4.3 trillion readers daily, but in fact had 3.1 million last month. Sometimes it feels as if Onion writers are so outraged and exhausted by the administration that they do not know how to respond. Republican infighting erupts over whether Trump bill, beautiful or handsome, is only a 5 out of 10 gag. After Mr. Trump's national security advisor accidentally included the editor of The Atlantic in a group chat about impending military strikes, the Onion's headline was merely workmanlike. I messed up at work again. Crestfallen Michael Waltz, Tech's wife, National Geographic editorial staff. The Bee's response, by contrast, was wonderfully sly. Genius Trump leaks war plans to the Atlantic where no one will ever see them. Learning what makes people laugh is valuable, especially folks on the other side of the partisan divide. It helps you understand them, and it helps you see your own shortcomings as others do. So it is a pity that Mr. Trump pays no heed to the amateur comedian and full-time economics professor who made the best joke about his tariff policy, riffing on a Republican campaign slogan. Justin Wolfers of the University of Michigan told the BBC, Trump has a pronoun problem. He keeps saying he's imposing tariffs on they, them, but he's actually imposing them on us. Slime and punishment. The Epstein uproar has revealed a danger for Donald Trump of a Justice Department that seems partisan. The saddest thing for Donald Trump, he said in an interview during his first term, was that as president, he was not supposed to be involved with the Justice Department. He was also not supposed to be involved with the FBI. That meant he could not be sure the government was going after Hillary Clinton. I'm not supposed to be doing the kinds of things I would love to be doing, he lamented, and I am very frustrated by it. Now that he has been reelected, Mr. Trump has chosen to do the things he loves, and he has set aside conventions that insulated the Department of Justice from White House pressure. He is paying a price for erasing any expectation the department would operate independently, as it did under Joe Biden in prosecuting prominent Democrats, including his son Hunter. Mr. Trump's bandying of conspiracy theories about Jeffrey Epstein helps account for the anger of his MAGA base at the nothing-to-see-here position of his top justice officials about records of the investigation into Epstein. But because he has left no doubt who is in charge, that anger is directed at him, too. Why is Trump blowing up his base to protect child predators, wondered Ann Coulter, a fierce advocate for the president, in a column in mid-July. It could have been worse for Mr. Trump. He could have had his first choice for Attorney General, Matt Gaetz, then a congressman from Florida. He withdrew just before the House Ethics Committee said it found substantial evidence he had committed statutory rape, an accusation he denied. Unlike Mr. Gaetz, Mr. Trump's second choice, Pam Bondi, has deep experience prosecuting crime, including child abuse. She spent 18 years as a prosecutor in Florida, then won 2 terms as state attorney general. A lawyer for Mr. Trump in his first impeachment, she claimed after the 2020 election that he had won Pennsylvania, which he lost. But before being confirmed as Attorney General, she assured senators that politics would play no part in her decisions. The explosion over the so-called Epstein files shows even Mr. Trump's ardent supporters are not comforted by her credentials or assurances. Like other top Trump appointees, Ms. Bondi pairs awe for Mr. Trump, the greatest president in the history of our country, she has called him, with conviction about the vast powers of his office. In her first day on the job, she issued a memo to her department demanding zealous advocacy to defend the interests of the United States. Those interests, she continued, are set by the nation's chief executive, and no attorney could presume to substitute their own judgment. The same day, she created a weaponization working group to investigate a special counsel who investigated Mr. Trump and the officials who investigated those who attacked the Capitol on January 6, 2001. Ms. Bondi has presided over the departures of many career prosecutors and shifted authority to Washington from U.S. attorneys' offices. Probably her most sweeping articulation of presidential power came in defense of the president's decision to defy a law banning TikTok. Abruptly shutting it down, she wrote, would interfere with the president's execution of his constitutional duties regarding national security and foreign affairs. The standard would seem to empower a president to ignore any law touching such matters. The endless personal drama of Mr. Trump and the law, his perils and escapes, his pardons of allies, his accusations of crimes by adversaries, can make it easy to overlook that. In bringing the Justice Department under his thumb, he is not just heeding his own druthers. He is also fulfilling a long-cherished conservative theory about how the constitutional system is supposed to work. Under this theory, changes after the Watergate scandal threw the balance of powers out of whack. Congress overreached in passing laws to constrain the president in matters from waging war to managing the budget, while new norms excessively shielded investigators and prosecutors from presidential oversight. The Constitution charges the president with ensuring the law is faithfully executed, and the extent of that authority has never been delineated by Congress or the courts. Mr. Trump may not have been wrong when he said in his first term, "I have an absolute right to do what I want with the Justice Department." Those who embrace such ideas argue that, unlike civil servants, the president can be held politically accountable for his choices. But this confidence seems misplaced when the president is a lame duck in an era when polarization has rendered impeachment futile. Further, having the right to such authority does not mean presidents are wise to exercise it, which Mr. Trump appears now to grasp, given his recent forays into implausible deniability. I have nothing to do with it, he insisted, when asked if he would appoint a special counsel to investigate the Epstein matter, though the White House has said he opposed the idea. The erosion of prosecutorial independence does not in itself mean that politics is undermining justice. It certainly does not establish that Ms. Bondi made an unprincipled decision in concluding, as an unsigned statement put it, that no further disclosure of the Epstein files was appropriate or warranted. The opposite could be true, that on studying the evidence, she bravely concluded not just that she had been wrong to promise truckloads of new information, but that Mr. Trump had been wrong to commit to releasing the files, and wrong in spreading rumors about Epstein. In any case, another test of Ms. Bondi's integrity and of Mr. Trump's supporters' faith in him lies ahead. Endorsing accusations by Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, Mr. Trump on July 22nd said Barack Obama committed treason in the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Whether it's a right or wrong, it's time to go after people, he said. Stop hopping. Want higher pay? Don't change jobs. For years, America's job market has rewarded the footloose. The surest route to a higher salary, the advice goes, is to string together a series of 1 or 2 year stints, each paying a bit better than the last. Career gurus on TikTok set videos of their own salary progression to jaunty pop beats, cloaking online bragging as guidance for the uninitiated. On Reddit, posters debate just how little time in a role a job hopper can get away with before future employers might start to fret about disloyalty. A year or so is the consensus, though a brave few argue for 6 months. Now things are changing. For the first time in 15 years, barring blips in 2012 and 2018, wage growth for job stayers, those who have stuck with their employer, is running faster than for job switchers, those who jumped ship, according to data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Hunkering down and impressing the boss may now be a better bet than polishing your CV or responding to those LinkedIn messages from headhunters. The woes of job hoppers are a particularly visible sign of a wider trend, the softening of America's once rock-solid labor market. Another sign is the rising unemployment rate for fresh university graduates who are struggling to persuade anyone to take a punt on them. There have been weak patches in the jobs market over the past few years. Some firms, like the big consultancies, vastly overhired during the post-pandemic boom and have since spent years painfully paring back. Coders have complained about poor prospects for a while. First, high interest rates hurt tech firm valuations. Then, new artificial intelligence models turned out to be particularly adept at programming. But a broad jobs slowdown is a fresh development. Even as the stimulus-fueled excesses of the post-pandemic years cooled, America's labor market remained impressively robust. For month after month, new payroll data would show that hundreds of thousands of jobs were being added to the economy. Now that motor may be slowing. June's payroll numbers looked strong on the surface. Some 147,000 jobs were added across the economy, beating expectations, but half of those were in government, mostly teaching. Private sector employment, a better measure of the underlying state of the economy, was disappointingly weak. In recent years, there have been more job openings than people on the unemployment rolls, suggesting high demand for workers. Yet this ratio of vacancies to unemployment, which economists watch as a measure of labor market health, has recently fallen back to 1, meaning there are about as many openings as job seekers, and the share of small business owners who are planning to raise hiring or salaries is at its lowest since the pandemic. What does all this mean for America's would-be job hoppers? Once labor markets start cracking, they have a habit of deteriorating further. The Federal Reserve may, in due course, come to the rescue by lowering interest rates, but only after it can be persuaded that tariffs will not set off another round of inflation. If ever there was a time to redecorate your office and invest in a comfier chair, now might be it. You could be there for a while. This week's obituary is for Fauja Singh. The world's oldest marathon runner died on July 14th, probably aged 114. If the age of a man could be known as easily as counting the rings on a tree, there might be no doubt about the age of Fauja Singh. His passport said he was born in 1911, but at that date in British-ruled India, villagers like him got no birth certificates because the question kept coming up as his tall runner's body grew thinner and his white beard ever longer. He took to saying that he couldn't remember how old he was. Since everything was on the internet, people could just look there. In contrast to this vagueness about years, his career in old age was timed to the minute. The 2000 London Marathon, 6 hours 54 minutes. By 2003, he could run it in 6 hours and 2 minutes. The 2003 New York City Marathon, 7 hours 34 minutes and 37 seconds. The Toronto Waterfront Marathon the same year, 5 hours 40 minutes and 4 seconds, a world record for a man over 90 with an average pace of 12 minutes and 58 seconds a mile. In one day at a track meet in Ontario in 2011, he set 8 world records for a centenarian. From 23 seconds for the 100 meters to 49 minutes and 57 seconds for the 5,000. He tended to shuffle as he ran, almost always in his marigold yellow turban and blue and white running shoes. But he moved steadily and contentedly because he was so happy. The first 20 miles of a marathon he could take in his stride. For the last 6.2 miles, when he felt a bit tired, he would call on God and talk to him. Altogether, he ran 9. He sometimes claimed he did not go for records and that only his splendid coach, Harmander Singh, kept a list of his timings. It was true that, because of the birth certificate mishap, Guinness World Records would not recognize him. And being so old, he also often faced no competition. But if he heard that someone of over 90 had set a record, he went all out to smash it. It was extraordinary that his body obeyed him. Until he was 5, he could not walk at all. His legs were so weak and frail that neighbors in his home village, Bees Pond in Punjab, called him Danda, stick. He could stumble no more than a mile until he was 15. In consequence, he barely went to school. To allay the pain, he was given all sorts of medicines, and at night his legs were bound with bandages. Then finally they got better. When he went to work on the family farm, he walked in the fields for hours and started running, too. Village elders remembered him for the way he was always dashing about the place. Both he and God evidently saved his legs for greater things later. In his mid-30s, he gave it up. But when, in his late 80s, he resumed it, his regime was fierce. Until 2013, when at 101, he called time, he ran 10 to 15 kilometers a day. His marathon training track was a loop of roads in the East London suburbs where he had lived since leaving Punjab in 1992 or so. Again, he was unsure of the year. Come rain or shine, he would be pounding them. In the morning after rising at 7, he did yoga and meditation. At mealtimes, he would go to the community kitchen at the local Sikh temple, the Gurdwara, for a very small plate of roti, vegetables, and dal. No rice for him, nor parathas or anything fried. He drank mostly water and ginger tea. His secret, though, was to start each day with an Alsi Pini, a Punjab power ball of flaxseed, wheat flour, jaggery, and ghee. To his surprise, the pinis of East London were as good, even better than the ones he had devoured back home. It was grief that had driven him away. He had gone on farming for decades, making enough money to have a substantial house. Then in quick succession in the early 1990s, he lost his wife, his eldest daughter, in childbirth, and his middle son, Kuldip, killed when a sheet of corrugated iron crashed onto his head in a storm. After that, there seemed to be nothing to live for. His children had found jobs away or abroad. He was left with the laborers and the farm animals. Day after day, he would mourn at the spot where Kuldip's corpse had been cremated. As his son Sukh Jinder's insistence, however, he eventually went to join him in Ilford. He did not intend to stay, so much so that he never learned either to write or speak English. But the community was welcoming. He met his coach at the Gurdwara, and it was another friend who tipped him off in 2000 that a local 20-kilometer race was being held for a cancer charity. Though he was 89, he signed up, raised about $1,000, and his later life career was born. Running not only gave him a focus beyond his misfortunes, but he could also use it to help others. He gathered a group of elderly friends who liked to run also, and as Sikhs in the city, they raised money together. That group grew and grew. His almost last race in Hong Kong in 2012 brought in $25,800. By the time he was famous, the turban undoubtedly helped. He refused to run in the simpler Patka, insisting on full, respectful magnificence. Adidas used him for an ad campaign alongside David Beckham. The Queen invited him, and in 2015 he was awarded the British Empire Medal. All this attention thrilled him. He liked to keep up British standards and appeared most stylishly round Ilford in three-piece suits with a neatly furled matching umbrella. He had worn a three-piece suit to his first day of training, too. Supposedly, it was the British form. He was sorry, though, that because he had become a British citizen before his running took off, all his rewards were for Britain and not for India. He was sorry, too, dreadfully so, about retiring, although old age was his selling point. He could not accept it. If he stopped running, he might be forgotten. So when, in even later life, he returned to Bees Pind, he did not let his discipline lapse. His diet stayed strict, though he added feasts of mangoes from the tree in his courtyard. The pinnace continued, and, of course, the exercise, though it was now a four-hour walk every day when the afternoon heat relented. At 3:30 p.m. on July 14th, he was just outside his house about to start his walk when a speeding SUV hit him. The driver did not stop, and his family and friends could not help thinking sadly that Fauja Singh might not have stopped either. Indeed, gone on for years, but for that. This week in business, Donald Trump announced plans to relax regulations governing the development of artificial intelligence in America, including penalties for states with stern rules on deploying AI. Mr. Trump aims to unify an increasingly fragmented legal landscape for AI among the 50 states and to massively expand AI exports to Americans' allies. The president also signed an order intended to root out ideological bias at models, or woke Marxist lunacy, as he described it. Not on the same page, a report surfaced that OpenAI and SoftBank are at odds over the direction of the Stargate project, a $500 billion AI investment that was announced in January with the support of Mr. Trump. The companies are struggling to coordinate the construction of data entries centers. Countering the narrative, OpenAI said it had entered into an agreement with Oracle, another Stargate partner, to develop 4.5 gigawatts of data center capacity, though it did not say where or how it would be funded. Mr. Trump described Jerome Powell as a numbskull and said he would be out of his job as chairman of the Federal Reserve within 8 months. The president is waging a public war against the Fed for not cutting interest rates that fast enough, though he said recently that he would not sack Mr. Powell. Adding to the pressure, Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, called on the central bank to conduct an exhaustive internal review of its non-monetary policy operations, accusing it of mission creep. Alphabet's quarterly net profit rose by 19% year-on-year, and revenue from Google's search and advertising business grew by 12%. That helped alleviate concerns from investors that AI chatbots are eating into its core research business for now. Meanwhile, an AI system developed by Google's DeepMind was awarded the gold standard at the International Mathematical Olympiad, an annual event whose pre-university students compete to solve six exceptionally difficult math problems. It was the first time an AI reached the top standard at the competition. OpenAI said it had notched up a similar score to DeepMind, though it did not officially enter the contest. UniCredit, one of Italy's biggest banks, withdrew its hostile takeover bid for Banco BPM, a smaller rival, and criticized the government for trying to block the deal. The European Commission has also chastised the government for meddling in the takeover process. Coca-Cola registered another decline in North American sales of its trademark drink as health-conscious Americans seek alternatives to soda. The company is introducing a new version of Coca-Cola made with cane sugar, a change that was trailed by Mr. Trump a week ago. Some people think cane sugar is healthier than high fructose corn syrup, which has been used to sweeten Coke for decades. Both versions will be available. That's all the time we have for today. This has been Mary Kiefer with a reading of The Economist. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.